Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Meg Starr, Carlyle's Global Head of Corporate Affairs, for a discussion about the firm's sustainability efforts and this year's ESG report. This episode was recorded on June 25th, 2024, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before I turn to Meg, just a few words about what we're seeing in the portfolio and broader economy. First, the Fed, in its June meeting, released its summary of economic projections. This is the Fed's effort to guide market participants in terms of what to expect with regard to policy for the rest of the year and over the intermediate term. And I think that many people thought that the Fed was doing a bit of sandbagging, which is to say, trying to set a bar that was intentionally low in relation to what's going to be achieved with regard to inflation and what to expect with respect to Fed policy. I would say from what we see, that's not necessarily the case. For instance, the Fed expects year-end core PC inflation of 2.8%. That seems high because May's inflation, which will be reported at the end of this week, will probably be about 2.6%. So a lot of people think that, well, if inflation has already dropped to 2.6%, to think it may edge up from here toward year end seems curious, at least out of step with what's likely to transpire. But in fact, what the Fed recognizes is that the window over which inflation is measured, over the 12-month period where they measure annual inflation, is going to get more difficult from a comparison perspective. At the end of last year, the second half of 2023 was a period of very rapid disinflation. 5 of the 6 months had inflation of either 2.1% or below on an annualized basis per month. And so I think that that what the Fed recognizes from that experience is that it's quite possible that the recent benign inflation data could be an aberration as it was then. We've also focused quite a lot on fiscal policy. The fiscal policy is something that people, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about, talking about in apocalyptic terms, you know, that this is going to be something that is going to lead to de-dollarization or some financial collapse. But in simple terms, really, fiscal policy, deficit spending are just circumstances where the government credits private sector bank accounts more than it debits them. And what that, of course, means is that when you run large deficits, and right now this Congressional Budget Office estimates a deficit for 2024 of $2 trillion, or 7% of GDP, that means that there is a lot more credits to those private sector bank accounts than there is debits, which means incremental liquidity of about $1.3 trillion, based on our estimates, relative to if the federal debt were on a sustainable path. That means that there is, of course, upward pressure on inflation, potentially, the Fed has to worry about. Finally, I would note that the increase in asset prices in 2024 has been very, very narrow. You have only 3 stocks that account for about 50% of the year-to-date gains in the S&P 500. So there's reasons to be skeptical about the rally and whether it's going to fizzle in the second half of the year. But those gains are going to be reflected in 401k statements, the defined contribution plans of workers throughout the United States. And when they are, you're very likely to see, as of June 30, an increase in those account balances to reach over $10 trillion as of the end of Q2 2024, which would be record highs. So, you know, with that level of household wealth, of course, households also, very many of them protected from the increase in interest rates through those fixed rate mortgages that were taken out before 2022, you have a household sector that is in really very strong financial health, also likely to continue to contribute to consumption, again, potential upward pressure on prices. So for all those reasons, I think that people should look at the Fed forecast of year-end inflation of slightly less than 3% and maybe one rate cut this year as a, you know, something reasonable that kind of bisects that range of potential outcomes for year-end, and not at all as something that is a low bar that is very likely to be exceeded or is in any way create some asymmetry in the distribution of potential outcomes. So with that, I'd like to turn to Meg, and thank you so much for joining the podcast this month.
Thanks, Jason. I'm a big fan of the pod, so I'm excited to be here.
Well, yeah, no, we only have fans on, so very much appreciative that you could join. So we want to talk about the ESG report 2024. This year, it's titled Sustainable Pathways. And the title is of interest, of course, because recently we had Jeff Currie on the podcast to discuss the idea of energy pathways and thinking about what I think are, if not common, well understood topics, but in a different way, in a different context that sort of broadens understanding the application, you know, again, potential path ahead. And I'm wondering if you could expand on what it is that you mean or what this title of Sustainable Pathways, what it implies.
Thanks, Jason. So I actually want to start by talking about the elephant in the room, and that's the ESG backlash, because I think it's hard to have a conversation around sustainability right now without addressing that. And so to really simplify what's happening right now, there's kind of two sides in the investment world. You see one side saying, I do not want you as my investment manager to be making personal, political, moral decisions in my investments. You have the other side that's saying, no, actually, I'm a fiduciary. And so, of course, I'm using a fulsome set of data, analytics, insights, specifically because I think that drives better financial outcomes for you. And so what we have is a disagreement about how we're framing the question, but actually a lot of agreement about the underlying approach. You're an economist. Of course, you would use any data set as long as it was high quality and it was financially relevant in your research, but it's a matter of what we call it. And so a really simplistic way of illustrating that would be to ask an investor today, okay, I'm managing a portfolio of coastal real estate for you, for example. Do you want me to think about floodplains, insurability, the physical hardening of infrastructure, what wind speeds the structures are rated to, et cetera, in managing your assets? My bet is most investors would say, yes, obviously, please consider those things. That's part of being a good investment manager. Alternatively, you could ask investors today, do you want me to think about climate change in your investments? And a good chunk of investors might say no. And so fundamentally, we have a difference of vocabulary here, even if we fundamentally agree on investment approach. So we have to be clear about one specific thing, and this ties into your question about the title of this report. Where do sustainability data and insights actually drive better investment performance? Because at the end of the day, that is the one thing we all agree on. So last year, we titled our report, The EBITDA of ESG, and it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it was really meant to emphasize we are talking about direct correlations between sustainability and performance here. Where does energy efficiency drive down a company's costs? Where do sustainability attributes help a company win new customers? Where does the energy transition momentum lead to higher public market valuations? Where do quantitative ESG KPIs help us secure cheaper cost of capital? It is on us as sustainability professionals to show those exact pathways, because at its core, that's what we can all agree on in the investment world. So this year's report, it's called Sustainable Pathways, because we wanted to emphasize that there isn't a single super highway to what a sustainable financial performance looks like for a given company. There's no single scorecard, there's no single set of rules, there's no personal, political, moral point of view to apply here. Sustainability done well, it's focused on which specific factors are financially material for a given business, period. For a business that's powered by human capital and people, that might be creative ways of increasing employee engagement, productivity, driving down turnover and the associated replacement and training costs. For a carbon-intensive business, that might look like reducing the input costs and energy price volatility that we saw a lot of in the last 2 years by helping that company decarbonize. The pathway looks different for every business, and that's really important. But the core thesis here is, where is sustainability a tool for financial performance? Because at the end of the day, that's what investors want.
You know, you mentioned the backlash, which is strong language as it relates to ESG, but I think that you anticipated this many years ago. And the reason I say that, just in our conversations, you talked about the, you know, you could say formulaic approach to ESG. I will buy this asset because it meets these criteria. I won't buy this asset because it doesn't. And you mentioned just the idea, what implications does this have, portfolio selection, for the actual underlying economic activity? And the answer was virtually none. I wonder if you could explore that a bit, you know, just the idea of selling a dirty asset. What does that actually mean for the fact that it's not in your portfolio, doesn't have real world implications, at least as it relates to some of the broader sustainability goals?
Sure. So Jason, I'm actually going to quote one of my favorite authors, who happens to be you. you did some research about 2 years ago. You had a report that was called The Inclusive Approach to the Energy Transition. And what I loved about the report was it dug into the fundamental underlying economics of fossil fuel divestment, which of course is one of the main original tools in the movement towards decarbonization. And what you found, which is actually quite common sense from an economic standpoint, is actually without having a fall in demand facilitated by structural changes in the way energy is consumed and produced, actually a negative supply shock caused by something like divestment could actually just result in a new equilibrium where prices adjust more than quantities or emissions. And so what that means is that to the extent divestment succeeds in actually depressing the supply of fossil fuel, it also increases their price, which means it raises the expected return on new investments in development projects, et cetera. So there's one argument around the economics of divestment doesn't actually have the financial or environmental intended impact. But I think one thing you and I have talked a lot about is this theory of change. And actually, from an environmental point of view, owning assets and owning the emissions gives you more control over reducing the actual emissions in an individual asset or portfolio company. If you look at emissions on a net level across an investment portfolio, the easiest and fastest way to change that is portfolio allocation decisions. Sell some carbon intensive assets, buy less carbon intensive assets, your portfolio looks cleaner. The reality is not a single molecule of carbon emissions in the atmosphere have changed. And so what we've been really focused on, and I think this is a reason why private markets are particularly well suited to this, is that having the ability to invest with a company for multiple years and focusing actually on the rate of change of greenhouse gas emissions for that individual business, along with corollary metrics, such as the amount of CapEx in energy transition activities, thinking about science-based decarbonization targets for the business, that is actually where you have the biggest real-world impact in terms of actual emission reductions. And getting back to where we started, this idea of correlation to financial performance, your research also demonstrated quite convincingly that there are real valuation impacts for companies that are seen as being on the forefront of that change over time, not just static state. And so companies that are disclosing greenhouse gas emissions traded premiums intra-industry relative to companies that don't. And then companies that disclose progress towards meeting actual GHG emission reduction targets are valued at around twice the level of companies that have no such disclosures on average. And so, again, we have to keep making that tie back to what is the fundamental investment thesis and how does that actually play out in terms of impacting valuations? So sorry to steal your research and say it back to you, but any other thoughts in there?
I appreciate that very much. I always like compliments, of course. I think we all do. But I think that this notion of a backlash is something that you anticipated precisely because the generalized approach to ESG was likely to generate it. So I did want to credit you with that and give you an opportunity to compliment me, of course. But let's just turn to 2024. If you could summarize, what are some of the highlights in this year's report?
Sure. Well, one of the big highlights related to what we were just talking about is the work we've set out to undertake in terms of helping our portfolio companies get onto credible decarbonization pathways. Again, because we think this makes them stronger positioned competitively and frankly, worth more over time. So back in 2022, we announced a couple of climate goals. These were goals, aspirational targets, but aligned with where we thought we could drive the most value in our portfolio. We set a long-term goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 or sooner across our direct investments. But we also set two near-term climate goals. The first one focused on our majority-owned corporate private equity, power, and energy businesses. It's where we had the most control, and it's frankly where we had the most emissions intensity. Again, we didn't want to set a portfolio-level emissions target because the fastest way to do that would be to sell carbon-intensive businesses to whom, to do what with, we don't know. We wanted to stay invested in those businesses, but help them build the capacity, the tools, and the technical expertise to get onto their own profitable decarbonization pathways. Mm-hmm. So our first goal was that 75% of the aggregate emissions of those portfolio companies would be on Paris-aligned climate pathways by 2025. We actually just hit that goal in June of this year, faster than anticipated. We had around 100 portfolio companies that were in scope for that first goal, and we ended up having 38 companies, which represent about 93% of the scope one and scope two emissions in that portfolio, achieve Paris-aligned climate goals. And again, the whole purpose of this is how do we work with our companies, particularly the most carbon-intensive ones, because those economic factors are most financially material for them as it relates to decarbonization and the financial benefits. How do we help prepare them for a changing future by getting them on a profitable, rational, CapEx-backed plan that helps position their company for the future? And so we are really proud of that and have a lot more detail in our report about the tools and resources and, frankly, the business plans of how companies were able to build that into their business strategy.
And then the report mentions decarbonization bootcamp. That's precisely what you're referencing here.
We make all of our companies do push-ups and burpees until they've lost all of their energy. Exactly. I think one of the benefits of being a private investment company and particularly having a private equity business is that we have a lot of reps because we've invested with hundreds of companies over time. We've seen pattern recognition. We understand different scenarios and we have centralized resources to help companies. And so after we had helped dozens of companies by hand set business-aligned, science-based climate goals, we realized that this was actually turning into a scalable curriculum. So we launched a decarb bootcamp in January of this past year, and we had north of 40 companies participate. And it's basically a six-month structured curriculum from soup to nuts, helping companies build the business case. Where do they have major customers that are requiring climate targets? Where could they significantly reduce energy expenditures through energy efficiency, et cetera? Actually map out the technical specs, build out a game plan, start collecting data and executing on those plans. So we're really excited about this inaugural cohort. And I think is a great example of where we can use private equity done well to help improve these businesses like we try to do on all operating dimensions, but particularly as it relates to decarbonizing. So these companies are better positioned competitively.
So among the other topics covered in this year's report is biodiversity. Also, we've talked about climate-linked financing, you know, which is innovative, very interesting. But I was wondering if you could discuss some of these other aspects, particularly the biodiversity, which I found so interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting because we see this concept in the world of sustainability a lot. I call it the concept of dynamic materiality. The basic idea is the world is not static. There are always new issues that are rising to the forefront and becoming material for businesses. Others that start getting priced in and so are just business as usual. Over the last few years, climate change obviously rose to the forefront, both on behalf of limited partners and general partners in terms of an investment area focus. Interestingly, we've seen a similar rise in attention for the topic of biodiversity in the last few years. Biodiversity is an interesting topic. When you think about it, nature fundamentally powers economic activity. When you think about all of the different ecosystem services that nature provides clean water, provides pollination of crops, it provides water purification. You know, nature sequesters significant amounts of carbon and has a real role in climate regulation globally. And so actually some estimates say that the value of nature from an investment perspective is around $125 trillion per year. Again, one of those estimates, who actually knows the accuracy of. So clearly fundamentally important economically. The real question though is, for companies and investors, how do you actually identify, assess, and address where these represent actual risks and opportunities? So we spent the past year building a biodiversity triage to actually hone in on the sectors, industries, geographies, and then individual companies where biodiversity could be a really material driver of financial performance. I'll give a couple of different examples. You have ecological risks. Certain companies have operational risks that are associated with resource dependency, scarcity, quality or deteriorated supply chain or disrupted business operations. How do you assess where companies have these supply chains that have potentially significant risks? There's liabilities. Significant liabilities might arise from unmanaged biodiversity risks. Think oil spills, think catastrophes with forest fires, et cetera. A lot of emerging regulatory risks. For example, CSRD, which is a new body of regulation going into force in Europe, impacts 50,000 companies globally. There are significant biodiversity elements to being in compliance with those regulations. Obviously, reputational impacts. And then importantly, there's market opportunities here. For example, there's 4,000 companies that are members on the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. Those companies are pushing those biodiversity requirements through their supply chain. So that's just a small smattering of the different factors we have to pay attention to. But the name of the game here, again, it comes back to what we started with, Jason. There isn't one set of rules. There's not one scorecard for what biodiversity looks like done well. You really have to apply this lens of what are the different financial levers and how do they apply to a given company and its core business to understand where there might be material drivers. So the biodiversity triage is something we are really interested in collaborating with others and developing an efficient, scalable tool to make sure we're focusing in on the companies that are highest priority in terms of making sure, again, we are addressing fundamental financial risks and opportunities in the portfolio.
I guess, again, listening to you, it's hard to understand in some cases why people don't want these risks managed, why they don't want to take advantage of the growth opportunities, potential sales growth that some of these initiatives provide. It's really, as you said, vocabulary.
Yeah.
You know, how someone talks about it. Do you ever get disheartened?
All the time.
That you might otherwise, you know, agree with everything that they're suggesting and you like the directions they're taking, but you recognize they're talking about a way that may ultimately be counterproductive because people don't see the basic risk management sales acceleration that's embedded in what they're discussing?
100%. And I think that's why vocabulary is both important, but then it's also not important if it is distracting from our end goal. And so some investors might not want to talk about biodiversity, but if you talk about water scarcity and how that's impacting supply chains, most people will perk up. And so I think it gets back to the role of sustainability professionals. It's a translation exercise. At the end of the day, you have to boil this down to dollars and cents, exit multiples, cost of capital, because that's a language that we all speak.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jason, and I hope I get invited back.
Well, congratulations on this year's report. It's something that everyone should take a look at. And I think, again, particularly as you prefaced this discussion in context of the backlash, I think it's something that everyone would greatly benefit from reading. So on behalf of the team here at Carlyle, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for our next episode of Insights and Indicators.